Hello and welcome to the Dense City Podcast, a show where we meet with academics to discuss their research on cities. I'm your co-host, Isaac Keast. Today we welcome Swedish author and academic Dr. Stefan Gosling. He's a professor at the Linnaeus University School of Business and Economics and at Lund University's Department of Service Management. He's also the research coordinator at the Western Norway Research Institute's Research Center for Sustainable Tourism and is on the editorial board of the Journal of Sustainable Tourism. Dr. Gosling has published, co-authored, co-edited, or presented a number of academic works, including most recently The Sustainable Chef with co-author C. Michael Hall in 2022. Today we'll be discussing his book, The Psychology of the Car, Automobile Admiration, Attachment, and Addiction, published by Elsevier in 2017. The book explores car culture through the lens of psychology. It looks at the adoption of the car into lifestyles and how the car impacts collective and personal identities. The book examines car drivers themselves, their personalities, preferences, and personality disorders relevant to driving. The book looks at the roles of power, control, dominance, sex, and rebellion to explain our car obsessions from an anthropological perspective. Is our love affair with the car more natural than we think? And how can we use this understanding to shape how we reach a sustainable transport future? Let's get into the episode.
Hello?
Hi, Isaac, is it?
It is.
Great.
Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you.
So happy you could be here.
Yeah, well, thanks for inviting me. It's great to be part of this.
So we'll get started the way we always do on the podcast with the purpose of your book. So can you tell me what the purpose of this book was and what you're looking to explore with it?
Yeah, I sort of ponder different transport systems. Different, in my view, is very often a transport system that has fewer cars. The car is very dominant. Many of the problems and inverted commas that we have with transport systems is that there's too many cars in the system. So we ideally want to get rid of some of them. And in 2016, I realized that the car is so powerful and so difficult to remove, then it's very important to understand why we are so attached to the car. And that triggered the idea for the book. And I did a deep dive into the psychology of the car, because I thought we need to understand what makes the car so important if we want to think alternative transport futures.
Right. It's clearly very embedded at this point and difficult to remove is, yeah, almost an understatement. It's especially if you live in a suburb, it's, you know, retrofitting is kind of the big question right now. But yeah, I guess my next question that leads to that is, what is the connection here between urban transport and psychology? Like, how are those things connected? Because I think when a lot of people think of urban transport, they think of a very logical A to B decision. I'm going to do what makes the most sense, what takes the least time. So, you know, where does psychology really factor in?
Well, at some level, it doesn't. You know, transport systems are always in equilibrium. You will do what you can, very simply put. And that means that if there is good alternatives to car transport and car transport is restricted or expensive or inconvenient, people will use different transport systems. Also, when you give them a choice and there's a good infrastructure for, say, cycling, for example, then people will voluntarily switch. There's also many experiments where we have like a fee for entering a city with a car, and that removes a large share of cars in Europe. But the psychology is important to understand what functions the car really has beyond the instrumental, because very often we think of cars as something that brings us from A to B. And I discovered that a car is so much more than just a means of transportation. It has affective values, and it has obviously symbolic values. And these are far more deeply entrenched with our psychology than I think most people are aware of.
Right. So that decision to take the car is also fueled by a number of things and also has kind of designed the environments around them. So,
yeah, no, you're right. There's like, you know, there's an evolution in how we relate to the car and what makes the car important.
You touch on this immediately in the condensed article version of this book, but you talk about the new mobility paradigm. And could you just explain to me and the listeners what that is? I hadn't really heard of it before.
Well, yeah, it's sort of the realization that many things are on the move. You know, we're living in liquid society, if you want, where ideas and things like garbage are moving globally. So we are all part of processes where things are in motion. And the car obviously has very important functions in moving people. And that is part of the new mobility paradigm that sort of tries to understand how, through a sociological lens, things and ideas are constantly on the move.
Okay, so the new mobility paradigm is sort of a recognition of a multifaceted influence on urban transport.
Yeah, it's maybe I can explain it with an example, but through the rise of social media, for instance, we've been able to communicate our transport patterns, which then has become a way of accumulating social capital. Essentially, you've been talking to other people about your travels and where you've been, and that has given you social status. And by, you know, gaining social status, there's obviously a repercussion here for how people think about mobility, because they start to understand that on the one hand that they can gain, you know, status in their networks through travel, but on the other hand that immobility also is a way of losing status because everybody else is on the move. And that means then that these new patterns of communicating and talking about what you're doing automatically feed into our mobility patterns and how we think about mobility. So that is an example of how in modernity, in our current society, social media actually has quite an important influence on how we think about mobility and how we engage with mobility then physically.
And I guess before we move further into the paper, could you give us a bit of insight into how we got here and kind of some of the things that drove that change towards car-oriented design?
Well, yeah, if you think about the history of the car, it's quite interesting to see it started with Mercedes-Benz more than a century ago. But the early Mercedes cars were just, you know, they were loud, they were noisy, they were stinking, they moved at snail speed. They were very unpopular, really. People didn't understand what you want with such a thing. But obviously, fascination with the thing that would move you, that you can even observe in small children who might get, for instance, electric mini cars, is very deeply set into the human psyche, I think. Something that moves you is attractive. So the car developed, and then we know the real success story started in the US, where mass production with the Ford T model was initiated, and that enabled a growing number of people to actually have cars. And you used them mostly in cities because they weren't very reliable, technologically speaking, and you didn't want to do long journeys with them for risks of breakdowns. So they replaced in cities what had been common to that point, which is walking. People walked, and you know, you had these new concepts of jaywalking all of a sudden because there were so many accidents. And then they also replaced the tram systems that we had in cities. They were actually purposefully bought by the oil companies to be ripped out of cities to make space for cars. And that then totally replaced the car system. And as often when you replace a system, you as much provide an opportunity for moving differently that then you also force people to move differently because the old system no longer exists. So physically speaking, you had this new system of mobility that all of a sudden was mandatory to some degree because other options ceased to exist. And then obviously there were, psychologically speaking, changes in how we looked at the car, because in a car-dominated society, all of a sudden, you know, having a car, having a nice new car became a status symbol with which people communicated who they are, specifically from the 60s onwards. People showed off, and that's still the case if you look at today's society, through their car, they communicate who they are. And the car hence became much more important as a sign value for people to illustrate that they are important, that they have high incomes, and then also they were quite instrumental, I think, in materialism and our orientation towards physical value that is, you know, presentable, like a large house or your new car or whatever else. And that has changed society then, as we know, in levels that currently today are problematic, because we know consumption is associated with climate change, for instance, and these issues.
It sounds like in a lot of ways they sort of commodified urban transportation and shifted that cost.
Yeah, definitely did. And not only a commodified urban transportation, it's also that in some countries the car had even other, you know, functions. Think about Germany, for instance, home to several large car makers, probably the second most important car maker country in the world after the US. And I think that in Germany, the car had this important function of, and now we're really getting into the psychology of the car. In the 1950s and 60s, the car became very important because people literally drove away from their history. I mean, the Germans had caused World War II, the worst, you know, nightmare in human terms any nation ever has imposed on others. And in this situation, the car was a way of looking forward, you know, of moving, literally moving away from the ugly past that people otherwise would have had to confront.
Yeah, I guess a train doesn't really give you the same feeling.
No, a train is not as flexible, individual. It's not something that you own, that waits and sits in front of your door. I mean, the car is a means of getting away.
Right.
That is probably one of its most important functions, because we all live in a fearful society, and then we're all anxious, increasingly so. And the car has very important functions in that respect too, to get away, you know, to be a means of flight, really. And that is deeply enrooted in how we look at the world and how we perceive the world. And it's not a coincidence that, for instance, in the US you have the largest cars in the world, because I think that is a reflection on how fearful the US is as a society.
I couldn't agree more. I live in Canada, but unfortunately, it's much the same here. We have absolutely massive cars. And if you talk to someone, you know what they're going to say. They want a big car because it makes them feel safer. And you know that safety comes at the cost of everyone else's safety. But they don't care because everyone else is getting a bigger car. So it's just sort of that snowball. And yeah, I've seen it happen. Just the insanity of trucks these days. Like, oh my gosh, if you look at a toddler next to a truck, you will have fear in your eyes, and rightfully so.
Yeah, you're right. And cars are also increasingly designed to instill feelings of fear in others. You know, it's not just that you're protected in the car, you also create cars that appear as powerful, that have large grills, that are building up high, that are, you know, impressing by mass, but also through the eyes. A car has a face that is proven in research. If you look at a car, you consider the car front to be a face with eyes and a mouth.
Yeah, can you actually talk about that a little bit, like the sort of anthropomorphization of the car? Like, I love that, but I'd love to hear more about that. Yeah.
Yeah, it's probably not purely by accident that the car front is perceived as a face with eyes. And my point here being that these faces become more aggressive, you know, the eyes are more slanted, the perception of the car is more like a predator in many cases than a friendly face. And if you look at cars in the 70s, for instance, they had round lights, and they were much more friendly in their whole appearance than cars are today. And even if you look at individual brands like BMW, for instance, you can see how over time the car becomes more aggressive, really. But we see cars at as beings because they look like humans and we can't see the driver. So the car automatically resembles, you know, a person that is inside. We don't know whether that person is really a, you know, reflected on or represented by what the car is like. But it's quite interesting because when people use the car in order to impress on others, you might have a driver personality who is a very fearful guy, you know, and just trying to tell others, please leave me alone. But you might also have a chance to actually have a driver personality that is reflected on in the car, who is a very aggressive person and who you'd rather not challenge in traffic because that guy might actually have issues. So it's very, very interesting to see these developments.
Yeah, it totally removes you. I've always found it removes you from the person. It's like you no longer have a face. You just have this massive hunk of steel that you want to blame things on, you know? And it's so much easier to take things out, I think, on a car than it is a human. Like, road rage doesn't happen on the sidewalk. People don't get mad at each other that often on the sidewalk. I think so much of it happens because you can't see the person and you can yell your head off and drive away. So it sort of gives an anonymity, and the car face is now your face, and it can be as big and mean as you want it to be.
Yeah, and you can hide in this anonymity because you are not to be blamed directly. You can get away with things. It's the car that stands for you on the outside. And I think it introduces aggressiveness in transport system when we can see each other. And also when we move at high speeds. And I think if you want more empathetic transport systems, then it's actually good for people to recognize each other and also to move at speeds where you can still, you know, communicate if by just a look or something that would make traffic much more human, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, I think anyone who has lived in a city or just a good neighborhood knows how much can be exchanged in, like, if you're cycling up to someone, you can exchange so much just by looking at them. Whereas across, like, a massive intersection, you cannot exchange a personal, you know, a glance and understand what that person's thinking. It's just, you're just all alone.
That's right, yeah.
Yeah, all alone is definitely how I would describe my experience in living in suburbia. It was especially, I think, and this is just sort of an aside, but as you couldn't drive when you're a kid, right? It's a totally different thing having to deal with cars when you literally can't drive them.
Yeah, that's the next big function of cars, really, when we talk about, you know, the different values that a car has. Actually, through a car, you can get community and be part of a social group, which is very important for humans. And that is, well, physically, because it connects you, it makes it literally possible to meet with other people. But very often these car groups are also, you know, they exist at different levels. Think about the early Tesla groups when Tesla still was a car to be rather rarely encountered in traffic. You would see the drivers would, you know, exchange greetings. You were part of that little group driving Teslas. And we've seen that with other car types as well.
Jeep is a big one.
Yeah, for instance, you also had, I don't know, these stickers on cars in the US that would identify you as Republican and so on.
I think you could have a lot of stickers that would identify you as Republican.
Well, I'm not really into that. Obviously, don't want to comment on U.S. culture.
Yeah.
But what is interesting here is that the car is really a means of community. And since that is so important for humans, it's a very important function of cars to connect people.
True. And, you know, I remember as soon as I could drive, it was always you and your friends in the car. So it did totally connect people in a lot of ways. I guess it's just you, when you're left with a lack of alternatives, I wonder.
Yeah, that is so true. I have a colleague who recently said, look, if you're like a teenager in Canada and you're going to a prom or something and you don't have a ride to pick up your girl, which in itself is a very traditional role model that is represented here. But if you can't do that, you're automatically, you know, out of the game. And also you'd probably be assessed by the car that you're driving, by the parents of whoever you're picking up. So there's a whole range of issues here that make it important to have the right car. And now that touches on yet another issue where the car is important, which is partner finding. You know, right. From having your friends in the car, that is one thing, but it's also, you know, how the car is instrumental in finding a partner, in impressing on people, communicating who you are, having your personal space in the car. All of that has great importance for young people in particular.
Yeah, I think in your paper, you even say like there's enough space to, you know, have sex in a big car. You can't just do that on a train.
No,
you know, a whole level of freedom.
rather not. And I think there was one US study that actually looked into the share of people who had sex for the first time in the car. And it was quite impressive. I don't remember the exact numbers, but very often at that age, you know, you're very restricted in terms of private space. And the car grants just that, right? It's probably not very convenient or consider
not ideal, maybe.
Some a replacement of a space, but it's a space that is yours, you know, that you can use. And that makes it very important.
Yeah. And it's combined because it makes that status impression at the start.
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess connection to community and reproductive success were aspects of car ownership that I hadn't thought of. And that's just a huge component right there of psychologically why we might be drawn to keep cars around and, you know, why we all love them so much, despite knowing that they're unsustainable for X, Y, and Z reasons. Yeah, I think you said it earlier, something that moves you is attractive, and something private that moves you, something shiny, something extremely expensive. You know, that is pretty ideal material right there. But yeah, my next question would be about mental health. You know, you talked about maybe some people owning trucks that are too big for them and some people owning trucks that maybe suit their mental state. And that, and sort of more broadly, how does it affect our mental health?
To start with, you know that we all have specific personalities that are measured in different directions in terms of how agreeable we are as humans or how aggressive we are in other contexts. And these personalities obviously are reflected in car choices. We all know there's the more hot-headed drivers, for instance, who will drive more aggressively. We were actually even able to link that to political
leanings.
Well, to political leanings, yeah, in a study that we did in Germany. And we could show that the conservative voters were more likely to have large cars, to drive more aggressively according to their own assessments, and to also be involved in more collisions, actually. That is interrelationships that we found. But then apart from that, you also have a great number of mental health issues. For instance, a psychiatrist has told me that they were discussing, debating whether someone in closed custody with severe mental health issues should be released because they knew that person would, you know, get into the next car and drive at extremely high speeds, endangering others. And there was an issue of like the personal freedom of that person versus, you know, the risks imposed on society. That is quite an extreme example, but mental states and mental health is related to transport choices on many different levels. I can actually perhaps report on my own experiences in Canada, where I used in Vancouver public transport and found it to be very, very different in terms of who else was on the bus compared to Europe, because the feeling, to be very honest, wasn't a very pleasant one. It seemed it was mostly people who for some reason couldn't drive, you know. Many people with mental health issues in my very superficial perceptual assessment. And that made it automatically an environment that was more socially difficult to navigate. And it's probably one thing there that when you for mental health reasons cannot use a car, that other transport modes become more important. So there's many different linkages here to mental health issues that I've also discussed in a separate paper because it's so complex. But it's quite important to understand that mental health issues are interrelated with transport choices.
Right. I live just outside of Vancouver, and I know exactly what you mean. For such a dense city, which it is actually quite dense, it's shockingly car-centric. I mean, people who live even a stone's throw from the city center own a car. It's quite shocking. But I mean, in Vancouver, it's very interesting because you have so many mountains and everything right at your doorstep. And Switzerland, I think, is much better at actually providing trains between places in the mountains, but there are none of that in BC. So if you want the freedom of enjoying the wilderness, a car really is your lifeline. Mm. And I've found that living here.
Yeah, I totally agree. The Swiss are actually a good example, not only because they probably have the best public transport system in the world, but also because it's known that everybody is using these public transport systems. So you might sit next to an important politician or business person because it's so common for everyone to use public transport. And that creates a totally different mix in this public space than you have in other contexts, and makes it much, much easier to use these systems because you feel like everyone is doing this. And that then, you know, becomes important when we talk about transport cultures, because they can be so difficult. It's so different and so difficult to change. In some countries, we have very bicycle-centric transport cultures, like in the Netherlands or in Denmark. It's just the common thing for people to cycle. If in Copenhagen, for instance, the Danish capital, you identify as a Copenhagener who is a cyclist, you know, the identification with the local culture is through the bike or bicycling. And the same is true for the Netherlands. And in other countries, you have different cultures where it's almost impossible not to ride a car, obviously. So there's huge differences in between the different countries and also in the size of cars. If you go to Italy and the big cities, for instance, or the French big cities, they are built very, very densely. For instance, in Italy, to create shading that keeps people cool in the very hot summers. And that means there is no space for large cars, for instance. So people don't drive cars to start with. And if they do, they are very small. And again, you have a very different culture there, transport-wise.
I was just in Barcelona, a few places in Europe last year, and the attitude towards people who are not behind a wheel is incredible. The fact that people have to actually wait at a red light if they want to turn right, for example. In Canada, you can just swing on through. But yeah, I guess you talked about how oil companies lobbied for the removal of streetcar tracks.
Well, that is actually a British sociologist, John Hurry, who died a couple of years ago. But he wrote a book on oil and how oil companies have bought the streetcar systems in, I think, 45 US cities in order to remove them.
Wow.
So they really literally bought up these companies that were the heart of cities to that point in order to remove them and make space for the car.
So they didn't lobby, they just got rid of them themselves. They did it from the inside.
Yeah. Oh yeah, they did. And obviously the idea was to get people hooked up on cars, which then would require fuel to run them. And that was their business model.
Genius.
Well,
yeah. My hometown is Halifax, Nova Scotia, a complete other side of the country from Vancouver. But if you look at old pictures of Halifax, you will see, you'll astound people who grew up in Halifax to show them that we had a vibrant and bustling streetcar network back in the day. Well, it was replaced with buses, but I mean, take a bus in Halifax and tell me how that works for you.
Yeah, plus a bus is not the same as a streetcar, strangely. It's again the psychology of things, but people prefer streetcars.
Right.
Because of the tracks, you seem to know where they're going, you know, they have a certain direction. With a bus, it's always an uncertainty whether it will go where you want it to go. I think that must be the main reason why people prefer streetcars. But streetcars are very popular with people.
Toronto might be one of the only North American cities that didn't do that. there's a long, long streetcar network. And you don't have to tell me, I will walk blocks if it means I can take a streetcar instead of a bus, because there's so much more space. They glide along the street. And yeah, there's something about, if you wait next to a bus sign, I'm always doubtful. But if you see tracks in a street, you're like, okay, someone paid for this. It is too good not to come.
Yeah, totally with you. It's an interesting effect that you have with the tracks and the perceived reliability of the systems. But yeah, people definitely love streetcars, that's for sure.
Now that's getting away from the psychology of the car and just into the psychology of public transport, I guess, because, you know, with each level of like infrastructure improvement, you know, like from a streetcar to a subway, maybe your psychological confidence might increase. You know, you have more confidence in taking that transportation because you know it's going to come. But this is just my armchair theory now.
Not subways, probably. Subways are located deep down, and that is a problem for many people. It's associated with many fears, actually. So streetcars are as good as they get,
right,
in terms of public transportation. But yeah, I'm with you. It would seem to be more reliable because, you know, they're coming through every 5 minutes or something, and right. There's a high frequency, there's many other people. But the very environment where subways are running is not ideal to, you know, appease our psychological needs for feeling secure and safe, unfortunately. It's also been, well, obviously, there's also many movies that have depicted, you know, horrific scenes in subway systems. So that also has relevance for perceptions, I think.
That is a good perspective, because for some reason I've never had that fear. I think when I moved to Toronto, I was just so excited to have a subway that I couldn't be bothered with the fact that it was underground. I thought that was cool, if anything. But I guess that is a good segue into when you were in Vancouver, did you take our SkyTrain?
No, I never did. Yeah.
But it is a cool alternative to the subway because it actually is, you know, it gives you a great view. Mm-hmm. So it would hopefully maybe ease some of those concerns.
Well, it's interesting to think about this for a minute, because when we talk about transport systems, you talked about you not being fearful of using these, but there's always, you know, a gray zone where people will actually start feeling fears, and then comes a threshold where people will not be willing to use the systems because of fears. And that's also the case in cycling, with cycling.
Right.
Because very often when cycling tracks or cycling paths are implemented, they are part of the road. And that is never a good way of doing this, because you don't really feel safe when a car theoretically can run you over.
Yeah.
And when you're feeling that you're very close to motorized traffic, and specifically when speeds are high and you're overtaken at speed. So it's very important, even infrastructure-wise, to think about the psychology. And you always want cycle tracks to be wide and to be separated from car traffic, for instance.
Yeah, I always learn so much by talking to other people, especially people who aren't in urban planning, actually, about how they feel when they're using systems. Like my best friend doesn't like the subway because the tunnel might collapse. And I was like, do you know how more likely you are to get in a car accident than that? But she doesn't care. You know, it's a mental thing that she can't get past.
Yeah, fears you can never address with rational arguments.
Exactly. The car does, if it feels safer, it feels safer. It doesn't matter if it is or not.
Yeah, and that actually is an important point, because we've done a lot of interventions where we try to convince people not to use the car, for instance, because of climate change. But what you really do when you design these interventions in the wrong way is to create something that we call cognitive dissonance. And by that, I mean that you get two different messages. One message is obviously my big spacious SUV is protective and a good protection. And when then somebody comes and points at that car and says, look, you shouldn't ride these because they are very, you know, energy intense and contribute to climate change, the person has to make a decision. You know, you ultimately want to be a good citizen. You don't want to contribute to climate change. But now you have to decide what's more important. Is it my protection, my safety, my family's safety, or is it climate change? And people will obviously decide for their personal safety. Nothing is more important than protecting your family, for instance. It's your genes that need to be protected. And the effect can be that people then question climate change because they feel bad about not doing the right thing, you know? And then the whole psychology of denial comes into play where people will say, well, it's just me. I'm not making a big difference in the world, or climate change is still undecided, not really sure if it's ongoing or not. And then you have actually achieved the opposite of what you try to achieve in this process. And that makes it so important to think about the interventions that we're using when we try to convince people to do things differently. We should never argue against the car, essentially, because of all of its functions. We should really find ways of arguing for better transport that is non-car transport, rather than to question the car.
That's a great point. You have to be sensitive of people's egos and the way people's lifestyle choices.
Also be aware of what the car means to many people and the many emotional you know, connections that are there. We've touched on some. It's partner finding, it's community, but it's also rebellion, you know, different types of, you know, showing that you're at odds with society. Very important for young people in particular. In that those values are very important when discussing alternatives, because we shouldn't overlook them.
Yeah. Can you talk a bit more about the car and rebellion? Like, growing up as a teenager with the car, of course, you're always aware of the rules you can break. And I mean, I think people most commonly break the law behind the wheel, maybe. So can you expand on that?
Well, in different societies, you will see that there's a different level of trust in government. I mean, government is ultimately something we should all support, because it creates the rules that are good for us to have. You know, we can have Wild West society. Everybody will agree on that, that a society without rules cannot function. So we have societies in which, in democratic societies, where the populace is voting for different parties that then create the rules for us all. But in some countries, people are not really feeling that government is representing them. You know, if you look at Scandinavia, for instance, we really believe the government has been, you know, elected by all of us. Hence, it's representing what all of us want. And hence, it's something to trust in. And it is an institution that's important. But if you look at North America, I'm not so sure that's the very same story. A lot of people are really at odds with government.
Yeah.
So that is one example of where we might have a situation where people are not really feeling that they are represented. And obviously, when you have that feeling that you're oppressed, perhaps, or abused, or that people have claims on you, like to pay taxes that are unjustified, you might, you know, have this feeling of avenging yourself, of taking some kind of revenge for being oppressed in different ways. And that can be done through the car. You know, you can ignore traffic rules, you can you know, engage in transport behavior that is legal but still create problems for others, like to drive very noisily or to manipulate your car into having very high noise levels, often still legal in many countries, but very, very obnoxious for people living in, say, a suburban environment where cars are passing through in the middle of the night with high speeds and that noise level. So there's many different ways of rebellion through the car that I think are not really acknowledged in terms of what they are, which is, you know, a note on not being content with how society is structured and working. And I think the car then becomes a mirror of how well society works, really. If, for instance, people, if we have societies where people want larger cars, more powerful cars, where the car is very dominant, that to me is a warning sign, where you really want to think about how society is working, whether or not fears and anxieties and feelings of revenge and the lack of empathy that is reflected in that is characterizing these societies, and where we should really work towards something different.
You just perfectly led into my last question, which is, how do our transport systems reflect the mental state of society? And, you know, if we are building these scary vehicles, why are we making them so scary? Which is a great question. Like, I have that question. Why do we feel that that's the direction we're moving in? Bigger and scarier. What does that say about us?
Yeah, if you look at society, I mean, we obviously live in global contexts now. At the same time, we are exposed to different fears that have grown over time. It's climate change for some. It's immigration for others. It's economic uncertainty for yet other people. For some, it's all of them. But I think for many people, the certainty that we had in the 1970s, the sort of structures that were in place that seemed to be more or less stable, they're increasingly uprooted, in, at least in the perception of many people. And that unfortunately leads to a situation where you feel anxieties or even fears. And when people are fearful, they'll withdraw. You know, you retreat into yourself and what's important for yourself. And you will feel that you need to defend yourself against society rather than be part of society and address the big challenges that need to be addressed in society. And that is a huge problem, because it means that when people are not supporting the big project rather than, you know, retreating into their own little problems and troubles, then it's very hard to address many of the big issues that we have, that we need to address as societies to create stable economies in the future. So the car is sort of an expression of that, in my opinion. It's a reflection on where we are standing socially and how big our fears and anxieties really are. Because if people buy these large and powerful cars, then very obviously they are not feeling secure. And hence, I think the transport system that we are seeing is a reflection on the mental state of society.
I think Scheller and Uri, you reference in this paper, and I just wanted to quote this. They say, "The body of the car provides an extension of the human body, surrounding the fragile, soft, and vulnerable human with a new steel skin." And there's a fear that that just quells a new, stronger skin that anyone can just wear.
Yeah, it's a very good last word, probably, that is how the car is enmeshed in our lives beyond the pure transport function, I think.
Yeah. And we always end the show with sort of asking, where does this go next? And I think my next question is, because this is sort of more, well, I don't want to call it subjective, but it's not like utilitarian to talk about this aspect of transportation. So how do you see this fitting in policy, and how can we sort of intervene carefully to make change while knowing this?
Yeah, it's a very big question, and there's not just one answer. But as I stated earlier, I think rule number one is to never, you know, go against the car. That will just create angry reactions and will create opposition. And sometimes, you know, I think change doesn't happen because it's very small groups that are very vocal that prevent change from happening, because they create these notions of, oh, there's a larger share in society that's against this or that, when in reality it's very small groups. And hence, I would always try to go for change that is indirect, where you, for instance, create better cycling infrastructure, and where you also argue for the car by working, if you want, against the car. And by that, I mean, for instance, that you can argue that, look, in most cities, we have a space problem. You know, we have congestion because there's too many cars. And if you want to resolve that congestion, you have to do something, because you can't build more roads. You know, we are physically restricted. There's no space that we can use. And the only way of then getting traffic to flow again is by making people that have been using cars use different transport modes. And in Europe, for instance, people want to cycle. You just have to provide them with the infrastructure. And if that is safe infrastructure, people will start riding bikes without any further trigger or incentive. They really do this because it feels good and because they love it. So in terms of the intervention and how it should be communicated, you could actually then tell car drivers that, look, this road will become a street road, and you will feel that we're removing your space. But we will bring a lot of people onto bikes, and all of these people will use a lot less space than previously. So in reality, we'll actually provide space here for you through this measure that then makes traffic flow better. And that is in your interest and to your benefit. And I think that's a kind of argument that is very hard to beat, because everybody knows that we have an issue. The number of cars is constantly rising. Congestion is getting worse. Something has to give. And this is a way of resolving these conflicts by actually doing something for both cyclists and car drivers at the same time. That is one example. There's obviously many others, but I think it's always good to argue in watertight ways. For instance, if you want to have traffic calming measures around schools, you should argue with the safety of the children, because we know many accidents happen close to schools because of, you know, the parent taxis, and also because speeds are not aligned with the reaction times of children. And it's a very good idea then to argue with the safety of children, because nobody can, you know, argue against that. Everybody has to be in favor of children being able to get to school safely. And using this kind of argument, I think it's very useful in then creating change, because by the end of the day, it boils down to removing cars from cities. And that is an uphill battle, unfortunately.
That's an awesome point. So let the people who want to bike, bike. Let the people who want to drive, drive, and frame it as everybody wins, because it's true. It's not a one person versus the other situation, and making someone feel bad for owning a car is only going to push them further that way. And I think it's true in Canada too, where we've seen cycle infrastructure invested in, we've seen people switch, and we've also seen people very mad about it, that there's infrastructure at all. So if we can say this is helping traffic for you, this is getting you where you need to go faster and us. So that's a great point. And I guess you wrote a book recently, co-authored in 2022, called The Sustainable Chef. And I haven't read it or anything, but I do think that getting people to change what they eat is maybe even harder than getting people to change how they move around. So if you'd like, could you maybe tell us what that book was about if people want to go read it?
That's an oddball book for me to write. But I've always had this, you know, I'm normally working with mobility and transportation, but I'm also working with tourism. And tourism, food is quite important, and food has many environmental implications. So working quite a lot with climate change, I was also interested in food systems and how these can be changed. And that really led to the Sustainable Chef, because it's like a summary of what we know about the sustainable kitchen, if you want, and what we can do food-wise in order to reduce environmental impacts, to get better food, healthier food, and more attractive food by the end of the day to people through the decisions made in restaurants. So that is what that book is about.
That's awesome. It caught my eye because it's always that person versus person. Like, what you're doing is unsustainable, change it. And we never get anywhere with that argument. So,
yeah, but again, that is about culture. If you look into a big German city like Hamburg, for instance, I think you'll find 20 vegan restaurants, and they are popping up like crazy because it's reflecting on an interest in the population. People want to eat good vegan food. You know, it's not something that is disappearing, rather, or crazy. It's something that is a market. Right. And where people really want to eat in these restaurants. I accidentally passed by one, and I thought, oh, it's great. I try this out. And I opened the door, and there was a lineup that almost went all the way back to the door. And I thought, okay, this place is popular. Can do it. But vegan food is no longer, it depends on where you are in the world, obviously, and who you're talking about. But
right.
In Europe, it's definitely not something that is uncommon, rather than probably the strongest food trend that we have had in decades.
Yeah. Well, thanks so much, Stefan, for your time. That was such an awesome discussion. And I can't wait to finish reading this book.
Thanks, Isaac. It was great meeting you. Have a good day. Bye-bye.
Bye. Well, that's all for now. I really hope you enjoyed. A big thanks to Dr. Stefan Gosling for joining us on the show today. To read the book we spoke about and to learn more about his work, see the links in the show notes. Please give us a review to let us know what you think of the show, and share it if you know somebody who might like to listen. To keep the conversation going and for updates on new episodes, follow us at Dense City Pod on Twitter and Instagram, and subscribe to the podcast wherever you're listening right now. A special thanks to Emily Wang of Emily H. Illustrations for creating the artwork for this podcast. You can see more of her work by following the link in the show notes.
Thanks as well to Reed Kai and Ryan Kinnear for the show music. See you next time on Dense City.